This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The Bernstein and McKnight Show.
You have to avoid being reactive, but you have to have a sense of how many wins it's going to take to win a division and the caliber of play that will be necessary to win a division. I think we're aware of how strong our division is from top to bottom and how little margin for error any team in the NL Central is going to have if they want to win this division, and that's another motivating factor for us this year. Not that we need any more, but you don't get reactive or fixated on what any other team does. You focus on creating sort of the highest upside and the greatest certainty and the highest floor for your own team, and then go compete and be prepared to make the necessary adjustments in season.
Middays on the Score.
That's a newly intense Theo Epstein, who has not backed off the stance that he took from his immediate season post-mortem after they were bounced out and done by the Brewers and the Rockies and here
themselves.
They are. And primarily themselves. Get used to this on Tuesdays at 10 o'clock a.m. Your baseball guest is going to be this man, Joe Sheehan, the Joe Sheehan Baseball Newsletter, Sports Illustrated, Baseball America, on Twitter at @Joe_Sheehan. Joining us on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline, Alpamonte Ford, 500 new and used vehicles to choose from. Hello, Joe.
Hey, fellas. What's going on?
Well, first of all, I'm really excited about this. I say that you're going to be a regular and can't wait for a terrific season. So thanks for agreeing to do it.
No, excited to talk to you guys. You know, Dan, you and I have been talking for years. I've got to talk with Connor on his show before you guys were together. And I love talking baseball in Chicago. It's such a great baseball market with the two teams and such a passion, especially right now for the Cubs with everything they're going through.
Well, you certainly share some more sanguine beliefs in their prospects in that despite what Pecota may say, you have them, after your analysis, winning the division, 93 wins. First, I think you should probably let the listener know how you get to these things. How much is metrics? How much is runs scored versus runs allowed? And how much is just your gut feeling on some of it?
Yeah, fundamentally, I'm projecting individual performance and then mapping that to the team performance with runs. I'm projecting runs scored, runs allowed, and letting that drive the wins and losses. That'll change a little bit because, you know, bullpens will affect that. The opinion of the manager affects that, although with Mike Mussini losing his job, there aren't a whole lot of manager adjustments in the projections right now. And let's be honest, guys. I mean, we're doing the best we can in March. All of these have an implicit range. I consider it successful if I'm within three games in either direction. So if I see the Cubs are going to win 93, you know, that's kind of – I think they'll probably win between, you know, 89 and 96. And, you know, you could say that that's a cop-out, that that's useless, but I don't think any of us are so good that we can say, oh, yeah, this team's going to win exactly 93 games. And in that division, you essentially have three teams that can reasonably get to, you know, the 93-95 win mark in the Brewers, the Cardinals, and the Cubs. I still believe in the Cubs' offense. I look at what the Red Sox did last year after Chili Davis left and the breakouts that guys like Mookie Betts and Xander Bogaerts had. And I think the chance that the Cubs in a post-Davis world will get back to the offense we expected them to have going into last year, I think that'll be a benefit for them. I'm significantly more concerned about the pitching.
I'm really glad you brought up the Chili Davis thing, him leaving the Red Sox and then Mookie Betts taking off like that. How concerned should Cubs fans be about Ian Happ's demotion after the Chili Davis effect happened? You know, his leaving has somewhat affected this lineup. It has somewhat affected the development of some of these players. Ian Happ was probably one of them. He was probably due for an uptick, and yet he's not made the major league roster.
I'm caught in that because I like Happ as a player, and I think he's got, you know, tremendous value as a multi-position guy, which, you know, guys like that are so popular in today's game. He, at his best, he's going to be a power speed guy. The strikeout rate is probably always going to be there. I don't think he's going to be somebody who ever hits 280, 290, but he's somebody who can hit 240, 250 and help you. If you say that he'll eventually have Chris Taylor's role with the Dodgers, I think that's a pretty good comp. On the other hand, by demoting Hap, it clears the way for Albert Almora, and I've been an Almora hunk for 4 years now. So I almost kind of – I have a hard time separating the demotion of Hap from the opportunity it creates for Almora, particularly given, you know, this pitching staff and the low strikeout rotation. I think Almora is a critical guy to have on the field for 1,000 innings.
One of the bounce-back candidates, obviously, is Wilson Contreras, and I don't know if you have enough of a sample size to get an idea of what a bounce-back season would or should look like for him. And then there's the negative defensively, and that he's just been such a bad pitch framer. I know that they've updated, Fangraphs has updated their WAR number and changed some of the pitch framing values around in a way that's really skewed, retroactively skewed some of the WAR numbers. But we've heard Contreras say, yeah, I was bad, I wasn't trying hard enough, I wasn't dedicated enough to my craft, that's a guy who ostensibly could be an MVP candidate. What is your range for his production?
I think the midpoint of the last two seasons, you talk about him as being an above average hitter, if not necessarily to the peak of that 2017 performance with, you know, hitting .275 or 21 homers. I think that the power will bounce back. And the question of the defense, you know, it's, we've seen players, their framing bounce around. When we first started talking about framing, Jonathan Lucroy was this, you know, framing god. And then all of a sudden, you know, he seemed to lose that skill. Framing seems to be something that goes away with age. We've seen players improve their framing. Tyler Flowers, there was a lot of talk this winter about the Twins working with their catchers to make them better framers. So I do think there's the potential here for that to be less of a problem. And you did mention the Fangraphs numbers, now that they integrate framing, the catcher values are all over the place. I think Yadier Molina is now the best catcher in baseball history or something, which I think if I say in Chicago, I get banned. But it's really something, as a stat head, I'm always uncomfortable when we make these adjustments to WAR, because it is hard to explain to fans, oh, that guy you thought was good is now bad, or vice versa, or he's, these numbers have bounced around by 10 wins. I think that's a difficult thing for a stat hit. But to bring it back to Contreras, I expect him to be a 3-4 win player this year. I expect to be a really good asset for the Cubs.
So, Joe, instead of doing, you know, the math on the radio, which everybody loves, let's start this way. Since we're a couple of days from opening way, we get to opening day, we get to do kind of a primer. How much do you think catcher framing really does matter over the course of a whole season? Because we've gone back and forth, and the math has literally changed over the last month.
I believe in the numbers. I don't think they should exist. I'm a very big believer in automated strike zones. I think that pitchers should be called where they cross the plate. And what the framing data tells us is that pitchers are called based on what the catcher does. Mm. And that just fundamentally, I think, breaks baseball. So I think these numbers are real. I think catchers are moving the needle 20, 30 runs a year, less than they were maybe 8 years ago, because now teams are selecting for this. Wow. When you start to select for catcher framing, you narrow the range of the good, you know, from good to bad. Ryan Domet dropped out of the league because he couldn't frame. Jeff Mathis has a job because he's great at it, but everybody is kind of moving towards the way Mathis does it. We're selecting catchers this way. But no, I absolutely believe these numbers are real. And that's why we're seeing catchers largely selected for this. And, you know, and not to go too fantasy on this, but if you're a fantasy baseball player, you're aware of this because no catchers hit anymore. There are like eight catchers who can hit, and then everybody else is being selected because they can move their, or I should say they don't move their glove from here to here. This is my other problem with it, guys. I feel like you shouldn't be able to be a 30-run player if you do something that literally no fan in the stands watching the game can pick up on.
Hell yes.
If you pick up on framing, you have to basically be watching it on TV. And it's invisible to fans in the stands. I just, like I say, I've got philosophical problems here with framing, but that doesn't mean, I can't sit there and say, well, I don't think this should be the case, so it isn't the case. No, this is a real skill that moves runs and creates value for players.
We were looking at some spray charts yesterday, specifically Eloy Jimenez, and looking at the power to all fields and the exit velocity to all fields. And then I was trying to match that up with the MLB.com story written by Mike Petrello, looking at four-man outfields and candidates to receive the four-man outfield that we're seeing all over spring. We know Bryce Harper will get it. We know Chris Bryant will get it. And I'm wondering if all of a sudden that, I know you said four-win player from jump. How does that change if more frequently people say, all right, kid, we're not even going to make you prove it against three. This is where you hit the ball. Here's a four-man outfield.
Well, I guess the idea is to hit the ball over the four-man outfield, right?
You know, ideally.
Off the wall or hit it over the wall. I don't think he's run somebody like Eloy Jimenez or really any of these guys at changing their approach. And even four-man in the outfield, guys, there's a lot of empty grass out there. There's a lot of places to hit a ball that you're still going to be good. Now, we're in the early days of this. We know that the traditional shift affects the batting averages of the guys who have been hitting into it. You know, Brian McCann lost 20 points of batting averages over batting average over 5 years. Joey Gallo loses singles. All these guys lose singles. It's going to take a while before we know if a four-man outfield is actually affecting the value of these players. So I'm kind of throwing my hands up a little bit here. Until we see a lot of four-man data, it's going to be hard to know whether it's actually hurting these guys. One thing we can say, though, is that you know, batting spray charts and fly ball ground ball ratio, that stuff stabilizes really quickly. So we're going to know very soon if Eloy Jimenez is a good candidate for this, and I suspect that he's going to be. I'm fascinated by the interplay between data, defense, and hitters right now, and I think it's a dynamic thing. I think over starting 2-3 years ago and going forward 2 or 3 years, we're going to see a complete reshaping of what it means to have seven guys on the field and where we put them.
So, Joe, I'm kind of split on the Jacob deGrom contract we found out about this morning. I'm glad he's getting paid like an elite player. On the other hand, I'm not going to celebrate a franchise that had outbid themselves by about $50 million in the span of 48 hours because they hired his former agent who told him that he was worth more money or that he had traded. How tenable is this Mets thing, and how are you looking at the deGrom contract?
I hate signing pitchers before I have to.
Yeah.
And that goes triple for a pitcher who will be 33 when the contract kicks in. The contract I always look towards is the Chris Carpenter one. Carpenter was hurt, got healthy with the Cardinals, was a great pitcher for the Cardinals. They signed him to an extension, a five-year extension, 2 years before they had to. And before the extension even kicked in, he was hurt. Justin Verlander is another one. Verlander signed a five-year extension 2 years before he had to, went into a sharp decline. Now, he's turned it around, but certainly that contract was more than it needed to be. I think the Mets have taken on enormous risk here. And, you make the point, Connor. This is an elite player. We want to see those guys get paid.
Sure.
I just – signing a pitcher 400 innings before I have to sign a pitcher just always seems to be more risk than I ever care to take on. Pitchers can go south in such a hurry. And, I wonder if the Mets do this, if his form – not that Brody Van Wagenen is signing DeGrom because he used to be his agent. But if you remember when Van Wagenen was DeGrom's agent, he basically made this huge speech about how if the Mets were serious, they would sign DeGrom to an extension. I mean, that was his job. But I think his quotes from when he was his agent have kind of queered this entire conversation.
After the All-Star game in 2015, things got weird with the baseball. And we know that. And we have some distance from it now to know that just balls off bats were going farther through the air for whatever reason. It did seem to normalize a bit. What do we know about the state of the ball now? Because you made the point of, look, any next pallet of balls floating on that in that cargo ship in the ocean could fundamentally change the game. What do we understand about the relationship of the ball to the game now, and what are we expecting for this year?
See, we don't. And that's I think, the risk baseball takes every year. The baseball changes throughout history. I mean, they're handmade, and each batch ends up coming out a little bit differently. And you stole my answer, which was going to be, there could be, a ship in the ocean right now carrying baseballs that are going to bring us back to a four-run-a-game environment. I want to point people in the direction of an article that Meredith Wills did last year for The Athletic, where she identified the thread that was being used as the biggest reason for why the baseballs had changed. And, Dan, you and I say the baseball's changed. Connor, I'm sure you agree.
Yeah.
Rob Manfred is still saying that the baseballs didn't change. Until the league itself acknowledges, even with their own data, which the research has been done, until the league says the baseball's changed, baseball's obviously not taking ownership of this particular problem. I think baseball's got to show, right now there's a range, right? Picture Titleist V1s on one end and Nerf balls at the other. There's a range in which baseballs can come out of the factory and be legitimate baseballs. And I think what baseball needs to do simply is narrow that acceptable range so that we don't have a situation where perfectly legal baseballs from 1 year to the next can go from being these cue balls 1 year to being kind of these, you know, softer ones in the next. I also think a greater uniformity between major and minor league baseballs would help too. You hear a lot now about hitters particularly come to the major leagues and they're hitting a totally different ball. Pitchers are adjusting to a different ball in the major leagues. This is one of those things where maybe in 1950 nobody would have thought about it, but it's 2020 and it's time for baseball to get a greater grip on the most important thing in the game, which is, you know, the baseball.
No pun intended. It's funny you bring that up, is because when we were down at Sloan Park, Connor was driving. We were leaving the park one day, and there by the back fields, there's a ball right in the middle of the street. So we stop the car. Connor gets out. He picks up the ball.
I did a rolling pickup.
Yeah, you
sir.
Did.
I did a
you
rolling pickup. Thank you very much.
That's true. It took a while for him to arrange the car properly, but he did do a rolling pickup of the ball. And it said, I looked at the ball and I said, well, this is weird. It said minor league ball. And it was signed by a minor league commissioner where I came up with every league, the Midwest League had a ball and the Sally League had a ball and the Texas League had a ball signed by that league's commissioner. This was just sort of a pan minor league ball. And I asked Jed Hoyer about it. And he said, yeah. And he goes, the seams on that one are way higher. I'm like, well, what are we doing here? Like, literally, you're sending a guy to a different field at your facility, and he's dealing with different seams.
Right, and I actually don't know. Like, for the sake of argument, if a guy does a pitch in a minor league game, do they give him Major League Baseballs, or is he using the minor league ball? Was it Darvish the other day that pitched in a minor league game?
Mm-hmm.
I thought I saw, or was it a backfield game? I forget what started. I mean, I'm kind of curious. It's like, are they going from baseball to baseball from start to start?
They are. And the reason we know in minor league rehab stints, we're reading stories about some of the catchers in the minors were so poor and were so unable to eat that when they were doing a rehab and they were bringing major league balls, the pitcher didn't care, the team didn't care. This one catcher they interviewed was hoarding the major league balls
for sandwiches
and then selling them on eBay so he could eat properly. So yes, I mean that's how ridiculous that story was, because they were bringing bags of major league balls that the minor leaguers are, oh, these are valuable. We have to sell these for food.
That's 17 stories in one, actually. It's probably more than we have time to get into today. But, yeah, so that's something that baseball really should. There's no reason in the world for the Major League and Minor League Baseballs to be different. None.
Joe, before we let you go, what's the unified trade deadline do?
I think it forces teams to make decisions. The biggest thing, I think, is it makes it easier for fans. Like, you and I, we all understand this stuff. We're, you know, on the far right edge of baseball psychotic. But the average fan hears trade deadline, and then 2 weeks later hears about how his local team is going to make a trade, but it's going to go through waivers and it's still allowed, and it's incredibly confusing. I think from a front-facing way, the unified trade deadline is going to make it easier for casual fans to understand what's going on. And honestly, it should be. The Yankees traded for Andrew McCutchen last year with 25 games left in the season. Now, I know the NHL's trade deadline is like halfway through the conference finals, but you really can't have a trade deadline that close to your playoffs. You want to have teams playing the last 2 months of the season with the same set of guys. So I think it helps the integrity of the pennant races. I think it helps the fans to understand exactly what's going on.
Joe, this is great. Looking forward to this every Tuesday. Thanks, man.
Thanks, fellas. Take care.
That is Joe Sheehan. You must subscribe to the Joe Sheehan Baseball Newsletter to be a properly informed baseball fan.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app, the biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.